ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
One of Australia's most recognisable broadcasters is facing the biggest battle of his life. Alan Jones has pleaded not guilty to multiple historical sexual assault charges, and now the case is before the courts.
I'm not going to dwell here on the allegations made about me, other than to say that I refute them entirely.
As witnesses step into the box and the evidence unfolds, the Case Of podcast will be your eyes and ears inside the courtroom. Search the Case Of podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party: change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and today I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. And Parliament's back next week after the long winter break. But honestly, PK, I feel like it's already in full swing. There are just so many pretty hot issues around this week, particularly, I think, tough issues for the government, including gambling reform and contentious changes to immigration policy that we're actually still just guessing about.
It's a really funny one because the Prime Minister and Angus Taylor are both on leave. And so we thought it would be a quieter week. But I don't know, when the cat's away, the mice will play maybe, because even the immigration story, we're going to get into it. But the way it played out, I think it has everything to do with the Prime Minister being away. And in some way, his lack of control while he's away, or his attempt at control while he's away. But I'll get into that. I've got things to say. Let's go through them, though. We've got the gambling inquiry, 2 days of explosive allegations and industry scrutiny aired at that parliamentary inquiry. Only 2 days, but boy, did it pack a punch and has led to the coalition essentially saying they won't support the legislation as it stands. It's also increased pressure on Labor to go further, although, you know, they're holding back in terms of their appetite. Again, we're going to get into that. And then Tony Burke, who's the Home Affairs Minister, was meant to address the National Press Club. We're recording this on a Thursday morning. Today was the day it was going to happen, and then it didn't. Postponed, it will happen. We don't know when, but less than 48 hours out. And the reason? The Cabinet didn't fully sign off on all of it. They said, nope, more work has to be done. You're not ready to go out there. We're going to tease all of that out too, Frank.
Yeah, nothing like cancelling a National Press Club to put chaos up in lights. Then also problems for the Treasurer and beyond, because we got some new data on house prices and there's a downturn. The fall in house prices is spread across the country. Labor is saying, look, just, you know, keep perspective on this. But, you know, there's suggestions of some significant house price falls, and this is always a pain point for a government. And then we also had Pauline Hanson launching her Victorian team, which is fine, wouldn't have attracted that much attention nationally, except she imposed a media ban on certain media outlets, including the ABC. We'll talk about this more with Tom too. It's a move right out of the Trump playbook, but, you know, then again, does talking about it play into Pauline Hanson's hands? We'll talk strategy here in a moment.
Yeah, does it play into our hands? It seems so. Our guest has been watching all of this very closely in Parliament House. Let's bring him in. Tom McElroy, political editor at The Guardian Australia. Welcome to The Party Room.
Thanks, PK. Thanks, Fran. Great to be with you.
Hey, Tom. Great to have you back. Tom, the parliamentary inquiry into Labor's gambling package, you know, really did dominate the news cycle. I think I was, the way I test this was I was off sick, so on the couch for much of the week. But I just couldn't stop, you know, hearing about it, really. And some of the evidence was jaw-dropping. The evidence, particularly from the ex-NRL player and former problem gambler Luke Bateman, he really led the charge before the Senate inquiry. He told the senators that when he was playing and when he was in the real depth of his gambling addiction, in which he said cost him, I think, $1 million or something over his time, he was offered drugs, he was offered thousands of dollars in free bets.
There were times where I would be flown interstate and taken to, you know, race days, put in marquees with alcohol and food provided all day, things like that. But also, before getting there, your VIP manager would offer you, go, hey, mate, what drugs do you want? do you want a couple of bags for this weekend? We'll organise that for you. We'll have that ready for you when you get here.
Luke Bateman has since confirmed he briefly worked as VIP manager for a New South Wales gambling company. The industry lobby said he didn't reveal this before the inquiry, and he should have, and it's clearly a conflict. But, you know, David Pocock, independent senator, who I think was the one who sort of brought Luke Bateman to the inquiry, said he didn't think that Luke Bateman was trying to mislead the inquiry. He said, in fact, the disclosure, quote, reinforces the weight of his testimony, speaking of his lived experience. So, Tom, as I say, I just found it really hard to turn away from all this really compelling evidence. Labor's already been facing criticism of this bill from across the political aisle, and particularly from within its own caucus. But I think this inquiry, it's only 2 days, has really served to harden the stance of particularly the coalition. And I don't know, the way I see it is the government will have to cede ground here, won't it?
Oh, yeah, I think they will. I can't remember evidence like this that changed the course of a bill or, as you say, hardened the kind of sentiment against a bill. For a while, it's been viewed as insufficient. The Prime Minister has dug in on this and says that Labor's done more than any other government and that it's enough. But I think Luke Bateman and Tim Costello have changed the game. Labor MPs were privately saying that it was good that this evidence had come out when it had. People like Louise Miller-Frost and Alicia Payne have publicly said that Labor needs to do more. And we've also learned in the last 24 hours that the coalition aren't going to support it. So that means there's no path for the bill in its current form, the Greens and the coalition both wanting Labor to go further. I think inducements are probably where a deal will be made. It probably means that a tougher bill will result from this inquiry. And I think people in the anti-gambling space, people helping vulnerable gamblers, people with addiction problems will be pleased that the result of this pretty sensational evidence is a tougher set of proposals.
Can I say I'm a bit confused about one particular element? There was a brief, clearly someone senior has briefed somebody. There was a story this morning, we're recording this Thursday, saying the government, you know, refuses to budge. It's take it or leave it with their legislation. Now, I know that's just one person briefing, but what on earth is going on with the government? Like, are they joking? Like, I laughed out loud. I did, not at the story, good story by Claire Armstrong, but by the audacity of saying that. Like, are you kidding? Like, as if they're not going to face any repercussions. Like, you take it, you don't want it, we're going to walk away from it. Oh, good luck to you. Are they serious?
Well, it's going to be a big political problem for them if they hold that line. As we say, the Greens and the Coalition aren't voting for their plan. It seems very unlikely to me that Labor would walk away altogether. And I'm told that the conversations so far between Sarah Henderson, the shadow communication minister, and Annika Wells, the communication minister, as recently as the past 24 hours, have been constructive. So I think that's probably, you know, a bit of saber rattling, a bit of public posturing, hardball politics from Labor. I doubt very much that in a week or two that will be the final position from the government.
It's interesting though, isn't it? And I'm still trying to work out why. The PM has been very hard line on this. I mean, for a start, Labor's taken over 1,000 days to respond to the Murphy report. That's the bipartisan Senate report that came out. They eventually unveiled a set of recommendations and changes which they knew would not satisfy. They were complicated. They were lackluster. To quote Sarah Henderson, the opposition minister, shadow minister on this, said, you know, this bill, we won't be supporting this deficient legislation in its current form. It didn't pick up the key recommendations of the Murphy report, which included a national regulator, a total ad blackout during sport and beyond, and a ban on inducements. And again, you know, Labor has played hardball, and it's been really all fingers pointing at the Prime Minister on this. And maybe you can help me with this, Tom, because I do not understand why, particularly given the pressure from within his own caucus, but also clearly public opinion, the PM isn't so far budging. I mean, this is the government that took on big tech with its under 16 social media ban. The Prime Minister prides himself on his political instincts. You know, he did get this wrong, I think, by all kind of measures. What's at play here? Is it pressure from the big sporting codes? Is it pressure from the free-to-air media companies who depend on this gambling advertising? I mean, there is a you know, we have seen this before. All these interests push back against, you know, banning tobacco ads, and it was banned and they've lived to tell the tale. I just don't quite know, as PK says, is he joking? What's going on here?
Is he joking?
I think he sees it in a different light to some people. I mean, the comparison.
Clearly.
Yeah, clearly. Tobacco is an interesting one. I think the PM views it as very different to tobacco. I think he sees having a punt, you know, following whatever sporting code or racing or whatever you like as perfectly legitimate. I think there is pressure from the broadcast companies, the big media outlets. I think the role of Peter Volandis and other big players in the sporting codes can't be underestimated. And I think
I think it's notable that the AFL and the NRL refused to appear before this inquiry.
Yeah,
I mean, it tells us a lot about these codes and the power they are pretty confident they will, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. And Peter Volandis' comments in the Sydney Morning Herald were pretty
outrageous.
Incendiary. Yeah, yeah. Making fun of senators on the committee, dismissing their work as unimportant. I think that's pretty amazing. My sense is that the PM feels like going too far on gambling would hurt revenue for the codes and for the media outlets. I think he's invested in NRL. Clearly, he's a Rabbitohs fan of many decades. Also, they're working on a deal to have the PNG NRL team up and running in a couple of years. But I don't think that position's going to hold very long at this stage. You know, if the legislation can't get through, this is something that's going to be top of the priority list when the PM comes back from his leave.
I mean, let's just remind people of some of what we heard before the committee in these 2 days, only 2 days, that a gambler was offered $50,000 in free bets despite the fact that that person had lost $500,000 over 33 days. $50,000 in free bets. This is what the gambling industry then went before the committee and defined as promotions, and including ex-NRL player Luke Bateman's allegations, telling us quite clearly that he was invited to events, he was wined and dined, he was duchessed by executives of sports betting companies, offered drugs, offered, you know, bags of drugs, so to speak. You know, the industry says, well, they don't know about this and that's just illegal. What are they calling? Are they calling Luke Bateman a liar? I mean, this is really, you know, hot stuff.
Yeah, their denials were pretty limited. They said they had no evidence of those kinds of claims. I think clearly there's legal inducements, those big dollar bonuses, you know, we'll match your bet or we'll cover your losses or here, take this credit. That's clearly going on. I note that the industry call those promotions and not inducements. But then this illegal stuff is pretty incredible. Tim Costello came forward with evidence of a person he's working with who's in prison after stealing millions of dollars to fund their habit, and that person being given free accommodation and induced to keep betting and lose as much as possible. These companies know how to squeeze a lot of money out of people who are committed bettors. And some of their tactics are clearly very out of step with community expectations, I think.
Yeah, very out of step. So just before we conclude this particular part of today's conversation, because there's a lot to talk about in this pod, you think they will have to back down to the coalition's, well, whatever they might be, whether it's the Simon Kennedy model, which is one of the backbenchers pushing, obviously, for a pretty, you know, a lot of change to the bill or a
particularly
more
particularly an opt-in
version.
Opt-in online model.
Yes. Yeah. Is that, do you think, where it's going to go?
Possibly. I know the industry is very much opposed to an opt-in model. They say that that wouldn't work. Simon Kennedy's a fascinating personality in this debate, and I think he's driving some of the push within the coalition and bringing along his colleagues trying to make the case to the Shadow Minister, Sarah Henderson.
The leadership of the coalition will toughen these gambling laws. I've spoken with them, and there's no doubt about that. The coalition will fix and try and fix these government's laws. This government laws have been a disaster, and the coalition leadership is committed to fixing them.
I think some movement on inducements is probably where we'll go.
Yeah.
There's also the push for a national regulator. We don't really have a good regulatory model at the federal level, but that might be more ambitious than the PM's prepared to consider.
I reckon the government will give some ground on how many ads and what times too. I think they might be prepared to, you know, open that window where ads banned during televised sporting events between, you know, up to 8:30 p.m. I think they could change that, for instance. So there might be some ground they'd be prepared to give, you'd think.
Yeah.
I think that that would be one step forward. And as Sarah Hanson-Young, the Green spokesperson, says, the industry is currently happy with Labor's proposals.
Well, the government's got to be prepared to negotiate, or the Senate's going to fix it ourselves. And of course, there's always, negotiation and compromise on these things. But what I'm really worried about, Sally, is that the compromise at this point is all on the side of the victims, is all on the side of vulnerable families. Because you know who's happy with this bill? The gambling companies are pretty happy with it. The big sporting codes are pretty happy with it. The big media companies and tech companies are pretty happy with it.
She views that as a signal that they are not effective enough, not tough enough. So probably something in that space is necessary to go a bit further.
I will say, when I heard the industry say, look, we're very, you know, this is okay, we can work with this, I thought, oh, okay, well, you know, you've just shot the bill. If an industry like that is really, you know, is all good, is like, this is good, we can work with this.
We can
Seriously, you've got to wonder about the teeth in the legislation. I want to change to a story that's big this week, but will be very big next week. I'm just very confident in predicting. And that is this curious decision that Immigration and Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke made to cancel the National Press Club address with less than 48 hours' notice. Now, it's just an address, you might be listening, my friends, as you're walking around the park, as I see many of you doing. You might be thinking, who cares? Like, it's just a thing. But it's very rare. I remember when Linda Reynolds, do you remember, cancelled her press club address? Like, it always sort of raises a lot of like, what's going on? And, of course, leads to inquiries, which is exactly what happened this week when it then got revealed that it, in fact, was a bit of a Barney, people playing down how big that Barney was. My understanding is you can call it a Barney, over immigration and the plan he took to the cabinet. Now, clearly we're going to see a plan that does reduce net immigration because the government thinks it's a political problem and they have to do something about it. But I think, Tom, there are some contentious changes and there's a sense that Labor was, you know, not all on board on this. What's your sense of what happened here?
Yeah, I think the cabinet conversations that happened earlier in the week were clearly contentious, and it's possible that they thought that everything would be settled, that people would be on the same page in time for a speech by Tony Burke today. Cancelling the speech, or delaying, I guess they say it's going to happen in the next couple of weeks, has really kind of supercharged this, as you say, PK. But I think once we see the changes, especially around family visas, you know, visas to allow Australian citizens and permanent residents to bring their spouse, their parents, their children here, that's going to be politically sensitive stuff, especially in multicultural electorates. And I think the government's starting point might be trying to take some of the heat out of One Nation on the question of migration, but it's possible that they could bring on more controversy by changing rules that a lot of people rely on.
Yeah, and it always was a little odd, I think, that Tony Burke was scheduled to give this speech at the press club when the PM was on leave, because you'd think when something like this is going before cabinet and, you know, getting nailed down, he'd want to be there, but so be it. It was always in the schedule, and anyway, it hasn't. They've decided to wait for the boss, which is probably a good idea. But look, there are real problems, okay? We've got more than 400,000 people in this country on bridging visas. They're clogging up the system. People are stuck for years. Many of them want to be. That's the whole plan. And Tony Burke wants to do something about that because Labor desperately wants to meet its reduced net migration figure, target, call it what you like, which I think is around 225,000 people. And they're above that at the moment and they're being hammered for it. And the One Nation pressure is just bringing that up in lights. This is, you know, this is always a sensitive issue for Labor. They're frightened of this issue. They want to try and nip it in the bud, but looks like some of the changes Tony Burke was preparing to put forward, like the family visa changes, are just a bridge too far. I mean, at the moment, people come here on a tourist visa to be with their loved ones, right, a partner or kids, and then they apply from here to stay on a family visa. And they're adding to that 400,000 number because they're on bridging visas then. And this is what Tony Burke wants to crack down on. But, you know, I think business Jesus makes a fair point here that if we are in a race for skilled migrants here in Australia, it's a global race for areas like construction, like IT, like AI. There's a whole lot of areas. It's not very attractive to someone to say to someone, well, you can come, but your partner and your kids won't actually be guaranteed that they'll make it in the 3 years you're being given your visa here, and they might have to wait 5 years. That's not a very attractive offering, right? Just on that basis alone, I think business in this case has, you know, a fair thing to try and persuade the government over. But there's a lot of elements, and there's, you know, overseas students coming here on, or young people coming on farming visas, things like that. And these are really sensitive areas for our economy. So it's a hard one for Tony Burke. He clearly, I think, was overambitious. It shows that Labor is spooked, I reckon. But there needs to be some limits within to try and get those people who are already in the country. I think that's the priority on bridging visas to get some of them home more quickly. And I think that's where a lot of work has to be done.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if they're going to deny the Coalition and One Nation this very powerful attack line of the immigration system spiralling out of control at the same time as infrastructure pressures and housing shortages, they need the numbers to come down significantly. But as you say, Fran, the balance of doing the right thing by the business community, making sure that we're filling these skilled worker positions, healthcare, aged care, housing construction, all that sort of stuff, it's a real difficult challenge. I think the starting point has to be good numbers, though, and Pauline Hanson and Angus Taylor are making out like there are huge hordes of people arriving. Mm. I'd say two things to that. First, the settings that they're describing from the COVID era were coalition government settings. And second of all, the overstatement to suggest that there's some, you know, loss of control or mass migration going on, I don't think is borne out. I think careful management is needed, but it's also important that we don't mistake political rhetoric for facts.
I think you're right. And I think, you know, careful management is exactly what's needed. And that's what I'm suggesting, is start with what's already out of control here within our boundaries, and then look at carefully managing who we allow in what numbers and what conditions in the future. Yeah.
Yeah. Can I say, though, I mean, yes, you two have had an excellent, I've been listening carefully, like, policy chat about the kind of direction it takes and how to do it. But I think it's worth just reflecting on the capital P politics of it. What an own goal, can I say?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Just, no, the management of this, did you see how quickly out of the blocks Pauline Hanson was making a video? I certainly watched it. I pore over this kind of material. A video so quickly saying basically, you know, Labor split on this, that Tony Burke can't get the support of the unions and others to do this kind of thing. Like, Tom, it was like Labor provided a gift, which is the political rhetoric that Labor is bitterly divided on immigration, to their opponents after all of this time neutralising the issue from yeah. boat turnbacks to... like that, and all I can see is that when the Prime Minister's not there, what goes wrong?
And you're right, Piquet, it's their Achilles heel, isn't it?
That's why I couldn't believe it, like that it sort of played out this way. Like, I don't know who's responsible for either the leak or who said in that cabinet room, hey, like, us delaying this is going to lead to this speculation about why we're delaying this. Like, did anyone think that was a big deal? Like, what? I don't know. Tom, help me.
Yeah, all from a rescheduled press club address. Who would have thought it could be so contentious?
I would have.
well, yeah, because it was clear. Like, sorry, but you sort of a very junior political advisor could tell you that that would be a problem. Like, your job is to look at where the fires are coming, again,
yeah,
to start.
But so is a bill, PK. So is presenting a change that's, you know, going to open up all these. Yeah,
I'm
that's
not saying
cooked.
They should have just announced anything, but like, someone said to me, well, Tony Burke shouldn't have booked that press club. Someone told me that in the cabinet. Okay, maybe that's right. I don't know. I'm not going to blame the man. I don't quite understand how it went wrong, though.
On the politics side of it, I think that mistake is clear. But wouldn't you think that if your big vulnerability with One Nation and the Coalition is the politics around here, that you would want your key salesperson, the Prime Minister, on deck when you were making the case? I think that might be part of the problem with the timing. You know, him being on leave when you're making this big pushback doesn't make much sense to me. It seems that they went over the top too quickly in getting ready to announce this. If they didn't have their ducks in a row in the policy sense and the political sense inside the government.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. Either way, it's just allowed their opponents to weaponise this, and I'm not saying they can't fix that. They've got enough time to reset. They obviously don't want to go into another election cycle with numbers being way beyond what they said they would be. That's what really is driving all of this. But, you know, I just think they made a bit of a mess.
Hey, while we're talking One Nation and Pauline Hanson, and, you know, I want to talk about something that happened this week. One Nation was unveiling their candidates there for the Victorian election, the upcoming Victorian state election. They're the leader in Victoria. They've nominated all of that. That's been problems around that, but that's another issue. You know, it really wouldn't have sort of dominated national headlines at all, if certainly not for long, except for the fact that Pauline Hanson banned certain media outlets from attending this launch. So it was, she banned the ABC, The Guardian and The Age from attending. And, you know, this is a bit of a running trend for Pauline Hanson. In fact, one of my colleagues reminded me that actually went on the election night in 1996, when she was elected as the member for Ipswich, she banned all the media from her event. And my colleague was reminding us how they were all stuck outside and One Nation people were putting stubbies through the window, giving them stubbies through the window. But she banned them all. So this is, you know, this is not new for her. People saying it's the Trump playbook. Maybe it is, but it's also, she's had a tendency for this. But, you know, Tom, I think this is, should not be allowed to go without a lot of criticism. I mean, it's one thing, and I've had it myself plenty of times over my career, for political leaders and politicians to say, oh, I'm never going to come on your radio show, I'm not going to talk to you. But to ban you from all their events and their press conferences, I just think that's, you know, it's un-Australian and it's not good for democracy.
I agree, it's anti-democratic. I think Pauline Hanson should act if, as she claims, they're a serious party, that they're a potential party of government at the next federal election, indeed at the upcoming Victorian election, she should act like it and she should take questions from the media. My starting point for these things is politicians, when calling press conferences, do not get to control the media that they take questions from and do not get to control the subjects that they're asked about. As you say, Fran, of course you can say, I'm not going to go on that program, I'm not going to deal with that particular person for a TV interview or whatever. But a press conference announcing your party's candidates and policies for the election, if you're not prepared to have all of the media there, I think you should take a good look at yourself and ask if you're taking the voters seriously. The media are a conduit for voters trying to make up their mind, trying to analyse policy and personality, trying to work out who to support in an election. If you're serious, if you're fair dinkum, you should not be talking about bans. They don't work. Pauline Hanson's history here is pretty clear. I defer to Margot Kingston's great Substack on this topic last night. She makes the case that Hanson needs to be serious about the media and the media need to be serious about Hanson. Maybe we need to work out some united approach to push back on these supposed bans. I think Pauline Hanson would do the voters a service by taking all questions from all media.
Oh, absolutely. I've banged on. Everyone's heard me. As my view is that it shows strength always when you can take all questions, right? You know, there's been famous moments where politicians have done that. Why is she doing it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, look, you know, lots of reasons. One of them is that I do think she has a worldview, which is that she is the victim of negative questions or campaigns from the media. She really believes that. I don't think that's,
yeah, but she was
right.
Doing this in 1996, right? So
yeah, but
the
she believed that
they had a chance to get formed.
Well,
and it was interesting that Margot
disendorsed.
Kingston was the only journalist allowed in that night. That's an interesting fun fact for us.
Yeah, it is. But she got really close to her, wrote the book.
She was writing the book on her, yeah.
Yeah, she got really close to her and kind of, you know, I think has a complex.
Understood her.
View of her, actually, a nuanced, complex view of this person. So I think she she does it because she believes it, which she thinks, one of her lines at the moment is it's not a forever ban. And it's almost like carrot, if you behave, you'll be allowed back in. Now, I find that problematic too. Like, what is behaving? Is behaving by her ideas of what's right? Now, I can assure you there are lots of politicians who don't really always like my questions. They've told me, right? But they'll come back on, they don't say to me, you better behave. If they do, I say to them, well, okay, I'm not going to sign up to your behavioural program. Like, it's bizarre, and I don't think we should be sort of falling over ourselves to comply with her false idea about what treatment she should get versus other politicians. Like, they all get scrutinised. Their holidays overseas, for instance, like the Sicily one, I can assure you if the Prime Minister was found in Sicily being funded by Andrew Forrest. I'm thinking of another billionaire. He hasn't been, but if he was, I reckon there'd be very high levels of media scrutiny on that. And if he then banned, us from turning up to his press conference, we'd go bananas, as we should. So I reckon the scrutiny is consistent, isn't it?
Oh, Scott Morrison's Hawaii trip's a perfect example. You can't hide from the media. It doesn't work. Pauline Hanson's trip with Gina Reinhart proves that. The photos got out, the information got out. She would be better. She would spend less energy interpreting tough questions as personal attacks, wrongly in my view. Answer the questions, show voters what you're made of. Don't be trying to hide from media. Don't be trying to ban organisations. It's anti-democratic and it's not going to work.
Yeah, but is there something else at play here too? Pauline Hanson knows very well, as do we, that the media is not in good standing with the public generally in terms of the trust measurements. We've had plenty of years of proof of that. So there's not a lot of people who are going to be, bleeding for us for being locked out of a press conference. Though, once you start to argue democracy, people might see it differently because free press is a core pillar of our democracy. But is this Pauline Hanson just trying to say, and this could be out of the Trump playbook, though I think she's probably always had this sort of arrow in a quiver, really, which is that, look over there. I'm going to create more headlines by doing this. I don't care. I'm just going to keep people talking about me. And the attention economy is half of it. And this is her way of getting a bit of it.
It seems to work for her, doesn't it? When she yells at journalists, she gets headlines for days and days.
Yeah. Everything seems to work for her. I mean, she gets a $2 million plane given to her, or $1 million plane, whatever it is, and it doesn't backfire on her.
Yeah, there's a touch of Trump there, isn't it? That Teflon, that kind of the usual rules don't apply to some politicians in the same ways. And I think some One Nation supporters would back her in 1,000%. They don't like the mainstream media. They don't like outlets trying to explain or contextualise policies that they support. And they probably support her for sticking it to the journalists.
Mm. Okay, sticking it to the journalists is kind of the vibe there, and I think that, you're right, that it does play out well with some parts of the public who think she's, tough lady who's standing up to people who are pushing her around. And that always can also work to your favour if you frame that right, and I think she's generally, that's been her whole shtick. Want to, again, dramatically change the conversation to something else, housing. The housing market downturn has spread beyond just Sydney and Melbourne, although, Sydney and Melbourne still definitely leading that downturn. Cotality has found national property prices in July fell 0.7%. It's the largest single monthly decline in value since December 2022, but it has happened, though. Then the NAB said that they think there'll be a 10% drop in house prices in Sydney and Melbourne. That's a prediction, hasn't happened yet, but this has got everyone kind of losing their marbles. The government's gone out and defended it all, saying, this just happens in the market. Okay, they're partly right there. Then Social Services Minister Tanya Plibersek told Sunrise, there's never been a better time to be a first home buyer. This is a wicked problem for the government, Tom, because that's part of the policy. They want house prices definitely to become more affordable. We are wild in this country with our house prices. We know it. We've been talking about it as a national crisis. But at that lower end of the market, they're not getting the kind of change they probably want. What's happening?
Yeah, I think there's a real political challenge in explaining this. You're exactly right, PK. They want some of the investor purchasing going on in the property market to drop away in order for first home buyers and people getting started with a home they're going to live in to have better access. That's going to affect the movements in the market. It's a vibes thing at the moment, I think. That being said, we'll see how this policy change goes, changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax. But if there was a drop in the order of what NAB's forecasting of 10%, that's going to become a very hot political issue. It's going to shift the game away from this intergenerational fairness thing and become a question of, look what Labor's done to your most important asset, the biggest financial decision you ever make in your life. I don't know how they're going to walk that tight rope. That's going to be a challenge for Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer, and for Anthony Albanese. Longer term, though, I suspect the ups and downs, the kind of daily or weekly results from market reports, from auction results, will float away. If it becomes a sustained downturn, however, that will be a really different kettle of fish.
Yeah, if it's a sustained downturn, you know, and we're talking over many years, that will have a big economic negative impact. But the problem in Australia, we've talked about this before, is that housing has become seen in our sort of national psyche as a wealth creation tool rather than just as a place for shelter, you know, that it's your home. And so that's how we see our house. And so when it says you're going to have a 10% drop in price, you think, oh, I'm going to be 10% poorer. Well, actually, you're not. You're still going to be in your house unless you're selling. And if you're selling and you're buying somewhere else, you're going to be buying in a market where houses are cheaper too. But, you know, the opposition is pointing out that there's going to be some first home buyers, 34,000 of them, according to their sums, falling or at risk of falling into negative equity if there is this drop in house prices. And they are blaming the government's tax changes primarily for that, though other economists and bank economists suggest it might be the high interest rates that are causing it largely.
It's column A, column B.
Column A, column B. Yeah. It is a bit of both, no doubt about it, because housing market is so sort of, you know, psychological, really. It's all about confidence. And this is why is it always a pain point for a government. But if it somehow manages over time and the government convince all those grandparents that they say were coming up and telling them they're worried about their grandkids not being able to ever get into the property market, convince them that they might have to take a little bit of a drop in the wealth of their prime asset, their family home, in order for their grandkids to get into the housing market, well, you know, that's the work Labor's got to be doing. So far, you know, they haven't been doing too well, I don't think, in the sell of all these changes to capital gains tax, negative gearing, the housing market that they announced in the budget. We've talked about this before. I don't think their sales job has been great. So, you know, I think that's where the work for them needs to be done. But there definitely is an impact from the government's changes and the state of the economy and inflation and interest rates on the housing market. It's yet to be seen whether people ultimately start to feel more comfortable with that and, in fact, welcome it for those who are trying and have been trying for a long time to get into the market.
Oh, yeah, the psychological hit that you described, this kind of national psyche, national mentality that we have that housing value equals wealth and that access to housing is part of our sort of birthright, part of the way we show that we're a section of the community, that we've got a stake in things, could take a bit of a hit. I think if in a year when we might be 6 months out from the next election, this kind of talk is going on, it'll be major. But the negative equity question seems to be a very small section of the housing market or the mortgage holder market. And equally, I think longer term, probably many of these things won't be sustained. So I don't know. I think it might be good politics right at the moment. I'll be interested to see how long it hangs around for.
Yeah. Mm.
Can I say, Tom, thank you so much for joining us on the pod. Just want to note something that you filed on, so have I. Labor MP Ed Husic, who was, of course, you know, cabinet minister, now a backbencher, pretty outspoken. You know, you can even call him Maverick if you want to use that cool word that we chuck in. It's a sad story, but also a good story because he's okay. Ed Husic was hospitalised this week after his car was involved in an accident with a truck travelling on Sydney's M7 motorway. The accident's really, really bad. I've seen some pictures of the actual car. Like, it's bad. He's been discharged now. He had a concussion. He'll be taking some leave too. Is that right, Tom?
Yeah, that's right. It looks pretty scary. I saw the photos as well. The car is really badly damaged, and I think the concussion suggests that he had a pretty bad knock. It'd be really scary, those highways and trucks.
They are frightening.
Oh, scary, yeah. I think it's good that he spent one night in hospital and was discharged. Hopefully the concussion doesn't linger. Probably a reminder to go a bit easier on the roads, but a scary moment. Of course, Anthony Albanese had his own serious car accident in Sydney a few years back. So these things do resonate. I think some of Ed Husic's Labor colleagues looked after him in hospital in the immediate aftermath of this. It's good that there wasn't more serious injury for him and for the other driver involved.
Yeah, shout out to Ed. If you're listening, Ed, or when you get to this, I hope you're feeling better. I hope you come through this okay.
Hear, hear.
Thank you very much. I'll let you go off and file your 200 stories. Tom, I know you're very busy.
Great to be with you guys. Thanks for having me, Tom.
See ya.
That's it for the Party Room today, but I'll be back with Mel Clark tomorrow to answer your questions for a special edition of Question Time Party Room. Please send us voice notes. They're the best. Doesn't mean we don't know how to read your questions, but yeah, if we can hear you, that's nice. You can record them and send them to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
Yeah, we can read. We reassure you of that. But David Spears is going to be back with the Insiders on Background on Saturday, speaking to Rachel Noble. It's the Insiders' 25th anniversary on Sunday. And, you know, so tune in for that. It's going to be some lovely...
Barry Cassidy's on the couch.
Oh, Barry Cassidy's on the couch. There'll be some lovely recollections. And, God, I've got many recollections of that couch over the years and some beauties. And then, PK, you'll be back with Politics Now from Monday.
I will. Not quite a 25-year anniversary, but we're going strong. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.